Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Today in the studio, we have Dr. Adrian Saville. Adrian needs a little introduction. He's the founder and chief executive of Cannon Asset Managers. He's also a professor of economics, finance, and strategy at the Gibbs Business School, who I suspect, or where I suspect, some of our audience members who are locally based here in Johannesburg may have come across him. He's also a published author who speaks regularly at different forums about investing, and particularly under uncertainty. I'm sure that word will come into our conversation from time to time. Adrian, welcome to our studio, and please tell us a little bit more about yourself. Give us a glimpse into yourself, if you can.
Thanks, Sai. It's great to be with you. You've done my bio in two lines. I think I've had the incredible privilege of being able to work in a business environment alongside my academic career, and the privilege for me has been that the way in which these two feed each other. You know, very often a question I get is, well, you know, how do you do both of these? Well, you know, that they jigsaw so elegantly that I think the business school classroom description would be these are multipliers of each other. Aside from that, or alongside that, perhaps I should be saying, I'm a dad, I'm a husband, I'm married to Tashmia Ismail. She's the CEO of the Youth Employment Service. And while I've been running my investment firm and teaching at the business school, over the last 2 years, she has created 37,000 jobs for youth in South Africa, doing absolutely extraordinary stuff. I'm a dad. I'm not sure that there's loads of time for many other things outside of that.
Absolutely. Just as an aside, we have recently taken on some interns, which was such a gratifying experience, and Tashmir and the team have been so wonderful at lining them up and making them available to us. So it's precious work that she and the team are doing.
Yeah, they're doing extraordinary stuff. And you know, one of my sort of table thumping points as a strategist and as a professor is, if you don't have a country, you don't have a company. And I think that point is harder to make in different environments, but in this environment, I would venture that, you know, that perspective or that reality has really landed, that, you know, people get it. If your context is broken, you may have a brilliant business, but this thing called economic gravity can suck really, really hard. What initiatives like the Youth Employment Service, in the run-up to this, we were talking about the primary healthcare business that Tash and I are involved in. These are the types of things that can change people's trajectories. And if you can change enough trajectories, the collective is called a community, and the collective of communities is a country.
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to take us a little bit onto the inside. If we talk about changing a country, I want to kind of, for a moment, kind of start off where it often starts, and that's in our imagination. Somewhere you've had the idea of building what came to be known as Cannon Asset Managers, and similarly, as you're thinking about a healthcare business, it's often when I speak to executives, particularly when I speak to founders of businesses, no matter how big they've become, no matter how they've diversified, there is always that very compelling story of where it started, and always starts in someone's mind. So if you wouldn't mind, take us back to when this all started. How did you know, and what did you imagine right at the beginning of what became what is now the business?
Well, I didn't imagine it. And if I had known where it lands up, you know, many people say, I would never have set out on this, because it's not easy, and it doesn't go in a straight line. And to get from there, which is the origins of the company 20 years ago, 1990, 2008 was the birth of the company. To get from there to here, there've been some exceptionally difficult yards. There've been some moments of, I think crisis is the right term to use, where you wonder if you've actually done the right thing. You know, have I made the wrong choice in being entrepreneurial and trying to build my own boat? You know, where it really starts or originates is in a love affair. And it's with a love affair of economics and capital markets that I was in a conversation quite recently, you know, talking about where this business began. And it began with me as a schoolboy building fictitious portfolios that I'd been given a school project. I must have been 13 or 14. And the school project was to build a portfolio. I don't remember how I did in that, in terms of sort of performance in the class. But I know what happened to me as a result of it. And I became absolutely fascinated with this thing called the economy and the elements that make it up, most obviously capital markets. And I then turned into this sort of teenage nerd. My parents probably wouldn't agree with this description, but this teenage nerd who was building portfolios. And there was a time, wow, you know, we're talking now 35 years ago, but there was a time when every single share price was read out at the end of the day on the radio at sort of 6 o'clock in the evening. And I would sit and jot down movements in share prices and movements in currencies and movements in the bond market. And that was the origins of this intrigue with investing. And from there, what did I say? The rest is history.
So that's fascinating, huh? So when I listen to this story, the one thing that does come to mind for me is you've obviously come across something that most other people did not notice, and it kind of brings me back to another investor by the name of Peter Thiel, and one of the questions that he often asks, and I love this question because it has this inherent contradiction in it. He talks about, and the way he phrases it is, what important truth do very few people agree with you on? What are the kind of secrets, the kind of things that you know are true, that you've come to realize that very few people agree with you on? And then when it comes to the world of investing, what do you say these things are?
I mean, I'm not sure that I can finish the sentence with people don't agree with me on these, but people struggle to get to this as a conclusion. If I could corrupt your sentence a little bit, and I mean to go back to the story of where Canon Asset Managers began. You know, I've described my economic and market fascination. I then became a student of economics at university. I did a bachelor's degree, an honors degree, a master's degree, a PhD, and very early on in my university career, in my first year of university, I discovered this thing called economics, and you know that economies could develop and flourish, and economies could be broken, and out of that you either build prosperity or you ruin societies. So, you know, there's always this bigger story going on in my head about what's the context, what's the driver. What's the long game? And I think that's one of the key ingredients in thinking about investing is so often the discussion is about, well, what did something do this quarter, this month, this afternoon? You know, Tesla is up this or Intel is down that. You know, those are near-term events and they may matter in the fullness of time. But in my experience of 25 years or so of investing, the thing that matters most is the long game. And very few people play that long game. They are either obsessed or distracted by the short game. And I don't think that I'm telling you something that most people don't know, but people really struggle with staying committed to the long game. And what I mean by that long game is the power and the influence of structural drivers, that it's very hard to know what the economy will look like at the end of this month or the end of this quarter, or we might have a fierce debate about exchange rates or interest rates over the next 12 months. That's forecasting, and forecasting is a treacherous activity that seldom lands up in the place that you imagine. But long game strategic drivers, I think, play in your favor, because they are there's deeper trenches that they travel in, and they have a far bigger probability, A, of working out, and B, when they work out, they've changed the environment in which you exist. So that's one of the things that's always going on in the back of my mind and thinking about, should I start a business? How should we position our portfolios? Which types of assets do we want to own?
I'm really glad you raised it. It's interesting in a way when you say, you know, playing the long game, and you come from an investing perspective. We see something very similar in pure corporate strategy. We work with corporates. It's not that they don't recognize the value of thinking long term. The system often forces you not to spend too long in the long game. You only have so much oxygen supply, and then you've got to go back to quarterly announcements, sends, et cetera, et cetera. Where playing the long game requires some skill. It requires you to use a different toolkit, and it gets you often to surprising outcomes. When you surprise yourself, we kind of go, I didn't think we were going to get there. And this is not 20 years down the line. This, given those deep trenches and the force at which these drivers often exhibit, that's like 7 years away. And in fact, one of the most, surprising things that the teams often come up with is, we can actually make a decision today around this. This is something we can actually take a stand on, a position on, take action today, tomorrow, next Monday, not 20 years down the road. And that's a different mindset. And I find once people understand both the power and their own ability to play the long game well, that's when they start to act differently. And their businesses look differently down the line. Such a fascinating field.
Yeah, whether it's from a business perspective or from an investment perspective, I would argue that these two things are equatable. You know, a business is really a portfolio of assets. Those assets might be operational, they might be people, they might be IP, but a business is a portfolio of assets in the same way that the investments that I manage, the wealth that I manage, whether it's for institutions or individuals, is a collection of assets. Mm. And you need that collection of assets to support each other, to protect each other, to combine into a cocktail that's more powerful than any one of the components. But the thing that I think is often lost in thinking about this long game, if we're going to use that term, is the power of optionality. Optionality means that you don't have to bet the farm. I don't have to put my entire investment portfolio or position my business as if one thing is going to work out, but I could have some exposure to it. And if it works out, it can transform my business. It could transform the portfolio. In this environment, I'll give you two examples from an investment perspective that we've had in our portfolios. The one is, for the last 20 years, I've been building multi-asset portfolios where you're exposed to different asset classes, different geographies, different currencies. And a perennial feature of that portfolio has been an exposure to physical gold. Hmm. And very often, you know, the question is, why on earth would you want to own gold? Because it just sits there. It's a lump. It's never going to multiply. And the gold is there because the optionality is the insurance that it represents. And the power of that insurance component has really come home in the course of the last 6 months or so, that it's behaved entirely differently and it's provided extraordinary stability. It's only a 5% holding in the portfolios. But I mean, that's one aspect of optionality. And then right at the other end of the spectrum, in our multi-asset portfolios that are longer range in their horizons, alongside the 5% gold, we've got 15% in biotech and AI and machine learning. Mm-hmm. So this is the, you know, this is the optionality, and thinking long term, I think, is about giving manifesting that optionality.
Now, you've raised the way you described the growth of your business earlier in the conversation was it wasn't in a straight line. And I suspect there must have been options that you had to consider. Some probably came as surprises and some were more planned and deliberate. Those, I suspect, must have had an impact on the trajectory of Canon as a business. Perhaps share with us a little bit more about that, at least what you can.
Well, I mean, I'm laughing because you know, you said there must have been, you know, some things that you know, don't go in a straight line, and you know, some moments where you have to take big decisions. You know, one of those decisions being, well, I don't think this is such a good idea. Maybe I should give up. and you know, so there are those moments of personal crisis that, you know, hang on, have I made this much harder for myself? You know, wouldn't it be easier doing either, you know, doing something different, working in a different business, or working for someone else? You know, there's that aspect. There's moments where clients fire you off mandates, and those are, I mean, those are just horrible experiences, because you know, it's hard to escape the truth then that you haven't delivered. There's the exhilaration, the thrill of winning mandates. And well, before we came onto this recording, I was telling you how, you know, we've been doing in this environment, and I'm absolutely delighted that in a very, very difficult business environment, we've been able to win two large new clients in the last 3 months. I mean, they really are needle movers for us. Mm-hmm. I think the throwaway term is game changers. But you know, none of this goes in a straight line, and none of this is easy. And I trace it all the way back to the origins of the business, where one of the things you asked me, you know, did I imagine building this? Well, I was becoming very anxious that I was unemployable because I had all of these qualifications but no work experience. So as I was starting my doctorate, and keeping in mind that I've done my qualifications in a straight line, so as I'm starting my doctorate, one of my closest friends said to me, "You know a lot about investing. We're in our mid-20s now. You know, you know a lot about investing. We're starting to get our first paychecks that, you know, people might actually say, well, that's an interesting number. For the first time, we've got disposable income. We're starting to buy houses, cars. We're getting increases. Why don't you help us invest? Because investing is alien and intimidating." And, you know, that's sort of one of the things that I would say, you know, people know, but they don't get to that conclusion, is investing is very often dressed up as complicated, complex, hard to understand. I would vehemently disagree. Investing is actually really, really simple. It's about getting asset allocation right. It's about getting your portfolio exposed to good assets. Getting fees out of the system, because that's one of the surest eroders of long-term prosperity, and then leaving the thing alone for as long as possible, in which case you've got the power of compounding in the system. And I think that that's investing. If you can get that right, and if you can get those disciplines in. So I probably used very different language to him when we were talking about this almost 30 years ago, but he said, why don't you start helping us invest? And so we formed an investment syndicate. And that syndicate had early success. And over the 3 years, We grew from our membership of 12 people at our first meeting to enough members that it actually justified licensing a business. And that was the company that I licensed in 1998. It won't be lost on you that 1998 was the time of the Asian and Russian crisis. So, you know, what a great idea. You start an investment firm in an emerging market environment during the Asian and Russian crises. And that was our birthplace.
Better, huh?
Impeccable timing. you know, and then from there, you've got the Twin Towers, global financial crisis, Y2K, you know, the commodities boom, the long super cycle that we were supposedly on. But if you think of the way in which the landscape has shifted over the 20 years of canon, 1998, China was a curiosity. You know, today it is the giant in the room. So that, you know, the environment has changed. We've walked through a number of crises. And each one of those events, whether it's winning clients, losing clients, having a financial crisis, having a boom, a bust, you know, all of them are moments for thinking really, really hard about what you're doing as a business. So if those things haven't changed your direction of travel, then you've probably learned nothing.
Yes. No. I want to introduce one more word into the discussion. And when you spoke about thinking long-term, and when we quickly realize that this affects both strategy from an investment perspective, as well as strategy from a corporate perspective, the other word that really comes to mind, and you've really triggered the thought on this when you spoke about 1998. And one of the things that we know is true, but not many people will admit to it or fully realize it, is that some of the world's most innovative companies started in times of recession, in times of crisis. And 1998 is just one year in which this was a very opportune moment. So I wanted to ask you, when we think about innovation, when we think about the potential to go beyond traditional strategic thinking, what role do you think this could, if not already is playing, in how we think through, respond to, and possibly emerge out of the crisis? Are you seeing another 1998 moment here playing out in front of us?
Short answer, yes. I think that this is a time that will go down as an equivalent of the collapse of the Berlin Wall, perhaps the ending of either of the world wars, World War I, World War II. Which both of those world war events brought about substantially different social, economic, and political orders. The same for 1989, the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain, and perhaps the birth of technology in the late 90s and into the noughties. You know, so I think that this represents a portal moment. Arundhati Roy wrote a fantastic article coming into the crisis, talking about the pandemic as a portal. And I think it is a portal for many things. And if the recognition hasn't landed that the world that came into this crisis is fundamentally broken in many ways. Inequality, social fabric, the building of walls as a way that people imagine, you know, the construction of walls and barriers and nationalism builds a more prosperous society. I think all of these have been drawn into stark light. And if we get it, then we will build a different place. And that's about innovation. That's not just, have I got a new box that can do a different trick? The way that many people think about innovation is, I've got a new device or I've got a new system. I think that the innovation is much more than that. It's about innovation in business models, economic inclusion being the most obvious point in talking about business models.
Mm. I really love the kind of analogy you gave to this when you talk about the Berlin Wall. Very often on CNN, they'll keep replaying that scene where you see people literally chiseling away at the Berlin Wall. And one of the things that it brings to mind for me when I think about innovation is, one, you know, as much as you hammering and chiseling away that wall, expecting it to fall, and everyone are cheering in the background, you actually don't know what's on the other side. You actually don't think about what will happen. What will we do once the wall falls? Or who stands on the other side is chiseling away at you? And where this came live for me, and when you spoke about innovation, is, and we ran an online panel discussion recently out of our office in Singapore, and we asked a very simple question. We asked the question around what forms of innovation you think will be most prominent over the next 5 to 10 years as we make our way out of the crisis. And what was quite surprising, perhaps it shouldn't be seen as surprising, but certainly kind of was highlighted in the room, was product technological innovation, while it certainly had its role, was a distant third. Commercial model and business model innovation was number two. The top ranking form of innovation that came up was regulatory innovation, ways in which organization will interact with regulatory authorities, come up with new models to provide regulation. That came out number one. Over 60% of participants from across the world voted for that form of innovation. It just kind of comes live for me when I think about, you chisel at this wall. I didn't think, you know, I didn't realize at that point that regulatory type innovation or that space would become so open and ready for forms of innovation. So
I love the imagery of your wall analogy. I mean, it's such a cool it really does sort of crystallize what innovation is about, because it's like rolling a rock uphill or pushing water uphill. It's thankless. It's hard yards, and you're not entirely sure what's on the other side, or even if there is another side. But you know what you imagine to be there. You know, in your reference to the different types of innovation, I think also is a powerful reference. You know, people are talking in the recent past about innovation taking the form of driven overwhelmingly by platforms as being one of the big changes in business models and deliveries. So it's all been about the platform business. But through the course of April or so, we ran, Tash and I ran a couple of surveys on social media, and we asked, what was the biggest obstacle to your business inventing, reinventing, transforming in the current context, in the very, very stressed context? What do you need most? And there were a couple of options that we allowed people to choose from, including the likes of, I need more capital, I need more people. Overwhelmingly, I mean, it was a head and shoulders vote for, I need less regulation.
Yes.
So we've regulated ourselves into paralysis.
Absolutely. And if I think of how this feeds into a cycle of a crisis of leadership in many respects, into a crisis of credibility, of reliance on facts, on data, on science, and now dealing with a crisis around regulation and the onerous results, assume unintended, that brought about, that could create quite a vicious cycle within which organizations would need to think very carefully and longer term about what their strategies are. Because strategy for me ultimately is about the art of navigation. But you can't just navigate the 3 inches in front of you. You have to be very clear both on the final destination and what are potential pathways to it. And knowing that you're still doing it in the midst of uncertainty, you're learning as you go along. So it's absolutely fascinating.
And I think that there's some examples that we can borrow from. Andy Haldane, the chief economist at the bank Bank of England, has a lovely example where he shows that the higher the level of regulation, the greater the incidence of bank failure. That it was the least regulated or the lightest regulated banks with the simplest risk models that had the most robust results. So, I mean, that would be one sort of reference point for me in thinking about regulation. And I don't think there's any regulator that sets out to the, you know, with the purpose being, I want to make this hard and I want to make things difficult for business. I mean, there is a purpose behind that regulation. It's not designed in a vacuum, but very often you land up in the wrong place. Because the system doesn't build what you imagine that regulation will create or engender. The second example that I would draw on is an entire country, and the country is Estonia, which has shifted itself digital. So when this COVID crisis struck, Estonia closed down their school system and they were running classrooms the following day from home. The entire country is digital. And that was achieved in the space of years, not decades. And I think the third thing that you make me think of is that you can't just imagine yourself to be just because you imagine it doesn't create it or doesn't cause it. You actually have to manifest it, and you make that point in your observation that it's not just about thinking longer term or where you might be. It's about how you navigate that, how you actually turn it into the direction of travel.
Adrian, when I think about navigation or the art of navigation, one of the things that we often come across almost without fail working with organizations is a change in strategy has a very clear and often profound impact on their portfolios. It may not be all visible at first. You may still be exploring potential pathways, but very often there has to be an important conversation in the room about what is our future portfolio going to look like? How is the portfolio changing? What are the implications of it? If I had to ask you in your work, how are you seeing portfolios and particularly corporate portfolios changing? I know it might be a tough question because it could be very specific to any organizations, but any thoughts around how organizations, even from a thinking perspective, are thinking through the way in which portfolios must change, and even the way in which we think about portfolios and the kind of the hard and fast rule that worked for us in the past but may not work for us in the future as we're navigating these uncertain environments? Any thoughts around that?
We've been involved in a study of over the past 20 years that looks at the behaviors and performance of successful businesses, and our measures of business success are fairly straightforward. Is the business successful in being able to sustain top line growth, revenue growth? Can that top line fall to the bottom line? And the reason for the top line growth is that you can grow your bottom line without growing your top line by cannibalizing, squeezing margin, killing costs, and so on. So we want to know that the business is healthy at the top line and the bottom line. Businesses that are able to sustain top and bottom line performance ahead of world economic growth and ahead of inflation, we regard those as being entities that thrive. And the fact that this has been going on for 20 years will tell you that they have thrived through the birth of the internet or the commercialization of the internet, the boom of the commodity cycle, the bust of global financial crisis, the election of Trump, Brexit, and now COVID. And what stands out is the enduring behaviors of these enterprises, that they've got things in their DNA that you would describe as, you may not describe as strategy, but they are in the habits and the behaviors of the businesses. That's quite a long answer to your question. And let me give you one word then that answers the question: portfolio. So overwhelmingly, these are portfolio businesses, and they know what to feed and they know what to shoot. That in my assessment, the job of the CEO is to allocate resources. And you want to allocate resources to businesses or parts of the business that are doing well, and to feed them and sustain them. You want to give some water and sunlight to potential green shoots. That's the optionality that we were talking about earlier. There's some businesses that you don't want to shoot, or parts of the business that you don't want to shoot, but you don't need to feed them. You know, those are your cash cows. And it's not embarrassing or shameful to, you know, keep them as cash cows, but their best days are done. And then there are parts of the business that need to be taken out and let go. And all of that is about the allocation of resources, allocation of people, time, capital, and strategy. And going on underneath this portfolio approach is these businesses have innovation entrenched in their behaviors and patterns. Innovation at every level of the business, from the coalface through to the C-suite. It's endemic in the business.
Fascinating, yeah? Absolutely fascinating. Adrian, we're getting kind of to the top of the hour. I imagine for some of the audience members who are kind of listening to us, some may be inspired, some may feel a bit anxious. Clearly, not growth does not happen in a straight line. It has some scary moments. Some days are not great. Maybe as a last thought, in any moments of success, in any moments along this fascinating, amazing, never in a straight line journey that you might want to share with fellow executives.
You know, for me, it's about purpose. You know, why am I doing this? And if I'm doing this to make money, then your purpose is probably misplaced. If you're doing it because of some force or obligation, then it's going to be difficult to sustain your motivation. So for me, even, you know, in these moments of darkness that I'm describing, that you know we've experienced in our business or in our country, if you've got purpose at your back, then you can keep going. So why am I doing this? And you know, that purpose is about, I'm doing this because I can change lives, I can have impact, I can have influence, I can do good things with the skills or the capability, the capacity that I've got. I think that purpose might change it certainly changed as I've gone through my career, that I've become substantially more interested in the social impact of our investments compared to 20 years ago, where 20 years ago I was trying to build portfolios that would help my friends because they were intimidated by investing. I think, you know, I'm now working in an environment in which I can have a far bigger influence and make a much bigger contribution to communities and country by working on the impact of portfolios and the impact of policy decisions and company strategy through my business school work. And for me, that's the exhilaration of every single day. I mean, there's some parts of days or weeks or years, months that are hard, but there is no time when I think, shit, I don't like what I do.
I absolutely love what I do because it has purpose and it has meaning and it has the capacity to contribute.
Well, certainly wise words. Adrian, I really appreciate the time you spent with us. This was such a marvelous conversation. Surprising in certain aspects. I think we've delved into areas we didn't expect in our pre-conversation. We spoke about the long term and thinking long term, and we spoke about how great businesses start. We spoke about the link not just to strategy but to innovation, and I guess we spoke about the personal nature of growth, how it affects us as individuals, not just simply as organizations. So really want to say thank you for participating here with us. I'm sure this was valuable as much to our audience. And for our audience, if you want to learn more about our respective work, follow us on LinkedIn. Further episodes will be released every second week. And we'd love to see you listening in or participating and contributing further on social media. We'd really appreciate it. Thanks again. And thank you, Adrian, for...
Thank you. It's great to be with you, and for everyone listening. And thank you for their interest.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.